Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Phoenix, Arizona, it's time for Phoenix Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Welcome to the Mind Money Motion program, where we focus on worrying less about money by keeping our mind and body healthy. I'm your host, Marie Burns, a certified financial planner, speaker, author, and founder of the education business called Mind Money Motion. My guests will help you improve your mind by maintaining a positive, active brain, your money, by learning to use your financial tools wisely, and your motion by incorporating healthy diet and exercise habits, all so you can enjoy less worry and more life. I want to thank my co-sponsor, the Women's Enterprise Foundation, for helping to make this program possible. The Women's Enterprise Foundation is a 501c3 charitable organization that supports and inspires women business owners. They believe that women are the glue for their communities because they participate in, orchestrate, and mediate relationships, opportunities, and business growth, which is why they offer grants and scholarships to assist women business owners in the Phoenix area. I'm excited to welcome our two guests today. I have with me on my right side, Maria Tomas-Keegan. She is a certified career and life coach specializing in transitions. She's also an award-winning author of Upside Down to Right Side Up, Turning Transition into Triumph, and producer and host of an international video podcast called Tips for the Transition. Maria will talk about the mind aspect of our focus. She'll talk about the times when your world is shaken by a major life event and bouncing back feels impossible. So she's going to share how you can get back to your powerful, resilient self so you can make choices that help you to turn your upside-down world right side up again. And Heather Parker is my other guest. From the Parker Law Office, she's going to address the money aspect of loss from the standpoint of legal documents. She'll explain various documents, what they do, so you can plan ahead in order to make an already stressful time less traumatic. Heather Parker is an attorney in Chandler. She focuses her practice on estate planning and business law. She realized this passion when she experienced a loss in her own family, which has focused her now on taking the time to really make sure clients understand the process and share their options for estate planning and business formation. She's been an attorney for almost 19 years and is licensed in both Illinois and Arizona. Thank you both for being with me this morning.
Thank you for having us.
We are going to tackle the topic of loss from a couple of different avenues. And with both of you dealing with loss in our lives, Heather, both before and after loss in a woman's life, and Maria, often after, but also before, but we know there are different kinds of loss. And so, Maria, I know you help women in a variety of transition phases of their life. So are there certain losses, though, that you find affect women more than others?
That's a great question. Affect women more than others. I don't know that loss can be devastating. And depending on what the loss is, sort of loss of a spouse, certainly. Loss of a career, loss of your kids, right? They've grown. You're now facing an empty nest, a divorce, just to name a few. I think one of the main things that happens in losses like that is that women especially are unprepared. Mm-hmm. And there are huge implications, many of which tie back to the financial side of the after effect of loss. So I don't know that there is any one loss that is more devastating than another, but I do think that there's a thread that ties through many of them, makes it difficult for us to bounce back.
And I'm sure we're all listening and agreeing with that. And I, you know, we're going to go through several different aspects of primarily the loss of a spouse today in our conversation. And so I'd encourage listeners to pick up, and I'm going to try to do this myself and reiterate at the end, but pick up some things that are ringing true for you that you might want to act on after listening in today. So the brain can handle about three things, they say, So I'll be recapping three ideas, or three takeaways, maybe three to-dos that our listeners might want to think about doing that Maria will share a variety of things with us, as will Heather. So when we think about potentially losing a spouse, I know the statistic is 60% of Americans die, whichever spouse it is, without having a will in place. And I think often it's partially the reason of why don't people buy life insurance? Because they're afraid if they buy it, they're going to die. It's the same thing with drafting estate planning documents. If we put them in place, we're going to die. It's almost like people are worried they're going to jinx themselves. So for the 40% of Americans that do put something in place, Heather, I would assume that you have to initially talk with them about what are all of the documents and why do they need things like a will or a trust? And maybe first, why is estate planning important in the first place?
Well, I think guiding us through the overall concern of loss, which people in general struggle with, regardless of whether or not we realize this is going to happen sometime soon or at any point in the future. And unfortunately, we're all going to have to deal with it at some point. Planning is important because if we don't specifically plan, there is unfortunately a state set plan for us, which we may not enjoy. So for someone who does not put something in place, the laws will come into play and that will dictate what happens, not only to your assets, but to your family. So planning is important if you want to make sure that things go the way you would like them to go. And part of what I enjoy doing the most is help guiding families through that process so that they're not overwhelmed and scared and understand that this truly is about making sure that they get to have things shake out the way they would like them to. Not only when there's permanent loss, but also at a time of incapacity, because that's something that's at least as important to discuss when we're talking about planning.
You know, that's a really good point. A couple of things came to mind as you were talking about that. One is, it's just like disability. People don't realize we often have life insurance in place for that extreme if you lose someone, but we don't often have the disability side covered. And the statistics are 1 in 4 Americans is going to become disabled before they retire. So the likelihood of you needing something like disability insurance, as an example, is even more significantly likely. So when we compare that to estate planning, it's not just the document that says, what about after I'm gone? It's the documents that talk about, okay, what if I make a trip to the hospital on my way to eventually being gone?
That's exactly true.
So if we go back to the state will decide for you, every state can have a little different tweak to that pecking order list, if I understand correctly.
That's absolutely correct.
So in Arizona, give us an idea. Somebody dies without a will and they have a spouse and or they have adult children. What would that look like with no will?
So unfortunately, the initial response is going to be the typical lawyer response, which is it depends.
Sure.
In general, the initial step is going to be all assets to the spouse. However, if we're dealing with a blended family, that may or may not be the case. So the statutes are segregated if we are dealing with a situation where we've got the spouse who passes, has children from a previous relationship, The division is different. So I would say that while it's important for anyone to have a plan in place, it's even more important for blended families to have a plan in place because they may or may not be interested in what's going to happen if they don't. So very, very important. Spouses first in general. So if we're dealing with just non-traditional, non-blended family, we've got spouses first step. If there's no surviving spouse, then it's children. And then it goes out from there. We can go back to parents and then siblings and out from there. And this can include half relations as well. So some families, that's okay with them, and some families, that's not okay. So all the more important as well. It's not only the statutes dictating the hierarchy, but that also comes into play when we're looking at what is a probate case and what does that look like? And each state sets their own threshold for that as well.
Sure, which brings us also to the reminder to our listeners that if you drafted documents in one state and moved to become a resident in another state, you may need to have your documents reviewed and or updated, which a lot of times I think people don't always realize. And Maria, as you're listening to this, you know, the statistics of how many don't have anything in place. You've probably worked with women, I'm assuming, in your business that have had a loss and didn't or did have. What's the difference in what you see, how that goes?
So the words that come to mind when I'm listening to Heather is peace of mind. Mm-hmm. So the women I work with who don't have plans in place, I suggest strongly that they find some financial advisors and attorneys that can help them put them in place so that they are protected. And peace of mind is, it can't be underestimated, you know, the value of that. When I'm talking with women who have not yet had the loss, this is an absolute. Unfortunately, sometimes when the loss has already happened, you know, the horse has left the barn, but there are still some things that can be done that she can mitigate some of the issues that may come up.
So if they have not experienced the loss, that might be a conversation with what I have learned to call ambiguous loss. They may be a caregiver. They have a spouse, but, and my mother is in this boat, he's got dementia, so he's gone, but he's not physically gone.
Right, right. And the caregivers can do a lot, depending on whether the caregiver is the spouse.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in that situation myself. So, you know, preparation is just so, it's just so important. And it's difficult to prepare mm-hmm. for loss of any kind. It's a hard thing to talk about. It's a hard thing to accept. But the reality is it's going to happen at some point. So being prepared and having the peace of mind that you are, and then once that's done, kind of setting that aside and now going on with your life, whatever that looks like, until the time that it does happen.
And in all those areas of transition that you were talking about before, Maria, the divorce or job loss, loss of spouse, a whole variety of potential transition areas, those are all times that considering either starting a plan, revising a plan, reconsidering what you did before, those are great times for that because, back to the peace of mind, that may be the one area in their life they can actually grab a hold of and create some peace of mind for themselves while they're trying to manage and deal with the emotions of everything else.
Exactly.
That's something concrete they could actually do.
Yeah, I work with women all the time just trying to recommend that they take control where they have control to take, because it is a remarkable healer when you can usurp some control over a situation.
That's a really strong thing to remember, is life happens to all of us. More frequently than we realize. I remember Money Magazine once quoted that the average American experiences one significant unexpected event every 10 years. So then I started counting. And I'm like,
mine have come
okay, I'm way above average. I'm apparently an overachiever because it's like at least six that come to mind within 10
right.
seconds.
Right. Yes.
So you can't prevent oftentimes the life happen parts, but there are things you can control. And so that brings us to the documents, which is a whole different lingo in itself, Heather. You know, people are confused and intimidated by legal lingo. And one of the first questions I always get when I'm talking to clients about estate planning or to groups is, do I need a trust? What's the difference between a will and a trust? That's like the key number one confusion, I think, in most folks' brains. So maybe you can define each for us.
Sure.
That would be great.
So we were talking just a few minutes ago about the state's sort of plan for us if we don't have one. So essentially what a will does for us is it supersedes that statute. So we get to indicate who do we want to be in charge of the distribution of our assets. And one of the keys about a will, which may seem obvious, is a will only comes into play when we're not here anymore.
So that's an important distinction to make. We're not talking about an incapacity situation. That's something completely different. A will just comes into play when we're not here anymore and we've designated who we want to manage our assets for us and to whom we want them to go. That's the nuts and bolts of it. Mm-hmm. One of the key issues of that is folks need to understand that a will does not stop a probate case. And a probate case is essentially the state's method of overseeing the distribution of someone's assets when they've passed away. And each state sets how much does someone have to have in the way of assets before we're going to trigger a probate case. In general, Arizona says that number is $75,000, $100,000 in equity in real estate if that's all you have in the state as a piece of property. Sounds like a lot of money, but you get there very quickly when you start looking at what kinds of things we're considering when we look at those numbers. So why is that important? Well, it's important because unfortunately, a probate case in this state is a good 6 to 9 month process. And what that means for us is we don't get access to that person's assets until the case is over. So if we have an asset to maintain, like a piece of real estate that perhaps has a mortgage on it, or even there's just taxes, insurance, upkeep, somebody in that family is going to have to figure out a way to absorb those expenses until such time as the case is over. So that's why that is an important distinction from a trust. And when we talk about a trust, there's lots of different types of trusts. But I would say the one that's probably the most prevalent is what's called a living trust, a revocable living trust. That would be something that can be adjusted and changed over time. What that does do, if it's properly, not only properly created, but what we call properly funded, it's essentially like creating another little entity. And we put the assets into the name of that entity over which we are still in control. So it changes nothing about how we use the assets that we put in it. We're still in control of it. We're still entitled to the benefit of those assets. But what it does do is upon the passing of the parties, the trust still exists and the assets are still in it. So when the parties pass, there's very little that's still in their individual name. So little to nothing that should trigger a probate case. So that's one of the many benefits of a trust and a reason why oftentimes people will select that path, because if done correctly, can avoid a probate case, which makes life for the family that's left behind a lot easier to deal with.
Heather, that raises a question in my mind about whether a trust overrides the need for a will.
That is actually a really good question. It does not. So any clients that I do trust for, they still get a will. And it's just got a slightly different term for it. We refer to it as a pour-over will. It essentially acts like a little safety net under the trust. So if we think about the trust as setting out what's to happen with our assets, and as a side note, the trust deals with not only what happens when we're not here anymore, but it also addresses how the assets are to be managed in a time of incapacity, which is kind of a double bonus on that. But what happens then is that is to deal with any trust assets. What do we do with assets that didn't make it into the trust or were incorrectly funded? And so now they're still technically in the name of the individual. Well, now we need a will for that. Okay. And what we do is we set it up, like I said, it's called a pour-over will, which means we state any assets that are in my individual name at the time I pass, I pour over into my trust. Because my trust is going to have a whole slew of specific terms and conditions that I couldn't put in my will. So we just want to put everything into the trust so that all those terms and conditions apply. So the will has a slightly different approach, but it still exists.
Interesting. That's a great safety net.
It is. And yet the one thing that I think clients hear when they hear, oh, good, I have a pour-over will, their mind says, oh, good, I don't need to worry about what they call funding the trust, which means retitling your assets into the name of the trust. And their logic is, oh, well, my pour-over will just take care of whatever I didn't. Let's just use your bank accounts as an example.
Right.
You have a large savings account, let's say, and it's in your name or even joint and then eventually in one of your names. If it's not titled the name of the trust, the pour-over will pour it over into the trust, but it has to go through probate.
That's absolutely
correct. Heather's nodding her head, and this is one of the biggest confusions I think out there, that people don't realize the homework that needs to be done after the trust is drafted to basically fund the trust, which I detest that legal term, actually. I wish they'd say, just retitle your assets in the name of the trust. I know that's longer, but it says what it is.
I would agree. Right. That's why I try to make my instructions clear like that and in plain English and not the, quote, legalese that most people are anticipating.
But I think also what happens is, you know, when you're signing your documents, it's kind of like signing a mortgage. There's how many papers, how many forms you initialed and signed a gazillion things, and your eyes are glazed over. You're just glad it's done. You're, whew, got that off my list. And so even if the attorney goes through the funding the trust part, I've even seen attorneys that draft a letter that tells the client, now here's your homework, go do it. And not all attorneys do that. I love the ones that do, because then as an advisor, that's my homework list with my clients. But they don't hear it. They put it in their binder with their documents and go home and put it in wherever their files are. And they think they're done.
It's all done. Mm.
So I make absolutely sure that they not only have that letter, but that I sit with them after it's all done and they come back and we put everything together in the binder and we go over those things. These are the things you still need to do. I have flagged the pages that have things you need. You have action items to take and make sure that it is clear that they understand that this trust will not help you if you don't put the assets in it. So it's really imperative that people understand the process, which is one of the things that I love the most about what I do, which is making sure that people are educated and can make informed decisions about how they're going to manage their families.
Excellent.
It's beautiful. Yeah.
And to me, that's an example of whether or not you have a good financial advisor. If you're working with an advisor, the minute they see you have a trust, they should be looking around, looking through your net worth statement to say, oh, and is this owned by the trust? And is this owned by the trust? And is this titled in the name of the trust? If not, then those are homework items that they should be assisting with.
Absolutely.
As we're talking about all of this, I know, Maria, you're nodding your head, and I'm wondering, in your experience with women, and you mentioned the financial being kind of one of the initial overwhelming, you know, challenges in loss when someone loses a spouse. If you have seen maybe the trust versus no document situation with women and how that whole loss transition goes for them.
I have some personal experience with this, not with the loss of a spouse, but with the loss of my father.
Okay.
And you know, he was very diligent, we thought, until he passed. And my oldest brother was the executor of the, or they don't call it the trustee, I guess, the trustee of the trust.
Yes.
Right. And he noticed that there were some things that my father neglected to, and he had dementia at the end, so it was a real trial. I learned from that experience so that I can ask some questions without being the expert, right? That you are, Marie, in your field, and that Heather is. I know where my limitations are, but I ask some questions.
Good.
and advise my clients and give them some recommendations of people they can talk to.
You're the radar detector. Good.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. You know, they can't heal themselves until these things are put to bed, so to speak.
True.
So that it's that peace of mind thing again. You know, a woman cannot start to figure out who she is now that this major event has taken place until she gets all of that stuff that is the financial and legal stuff taken care of so that she knows where she sits.
Yes.
and the point from which she can move forward.
So what would you say is the most common question from clients when they have had a significant loss in their life?
I'm gonna answer this question from the place where I just talked about.
Okay.
The woman has taken care of the legal and the financial stuff, and she's feeling the worst of the trauma is over. She's probably still grieving. But the question I get so often is, who am I now that I'm not Mrs. So-and-so, that I no longer have a spouse? Who am I now? And the question that often follows that is, and what do I do next? So those are very prevalent questions, and they're difficult to answer until and unless she's ready to make that step beyond who she was, right? Because she is now changed forever, and it will never be the same again. And coming to that realization is a tough one.
That whole who am I now, that identity. So that's really the biggest new challenge.
It is.
I've seen that in clients that I work with when they've had a spouse loss typically. And I almost feel like the process of seeing Heather and updating the documents and working with me on getting their accounts retitled or beneficiaries updated or whatever the financial process is, it's almost helpful and therapeutic to help them feel like they're at least moving forward in some capacity, because that whole identity piece is so hard and can take much longer than the paperwork process.
Absolutely.
Indeed.
Wouldn't you say? I feel like, you know, women at their core are caregivers, and we do identify specifically with those people that we are caring for, so be it. We start off as being somebody's child and then eventually move on to perhaps being someone's wife and then being perhaps someone's mother. And then when we don't have those identifying parties in our family anymore, or at least as the children grow and they're older and they don't quite need us as much anymore, and then we lose a spouse, we do really have that sort of identity crisis. And who am I if I'm not specifically connected to somebody else? And that process can be truly, truly as much of a grieving process as the loss of the person is as well, I would imagine.
It is all connected, absolutely all connected. And those roles that you spoke about that we move through in our lives, they're all transitional, every single one of them. When you move from your parents' home out into college and you're living alone, big transition. Getting married, having your first child, your kids grow up and leave home. All of them are major changing life events that change us profoundly. And often there is a cumulative effect if we don't deal with those transitional times along the way. Then when something, not that any of those are not major, they are, but when a life-changing event like the loss of a spouse, especially when you've been married a long time, happens and you haven't dealt with who you are as your life has changed and evolved from daughter to college student to wife and mother and then empty nester, etc., then knowing what to do next is really hard. And that's what I like to help women with.
Do you see that same transition? I would imagine I see this quite a bit. I have to imagine you do as well, that there's that following step, which is potentially becoming a caregiver of your parent or parents as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then being that place where you're trying to figure out how to take care of them, not only from a transitional standpoint, but from a legal standpoint, that can be problematic.
I'm sure it is legally and financially problematic. The other thing I see is that women find themselves in that caregiver role, whether it's for parents or a spouse, and you're grieving through that process as well. That's where the grief starts, and you're grieving for the loss of what was. And even though it's not ended yet, right, it is different. I just got goosies. This is a tough part of the conversation for a lot of women. But you grieve for what used to be. It's like the life I used to have was so much fun and it was so supportive. And then now all of a sudden it's not. And it's different. And I'm grieving what was, but I have to be present for what is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's tough, adapting to all of that change while you're going through it on a daily basis. It's tough.
It is.
Well, I would imagine in grappling with what you anticipated it to be and when it doesn't turn out the way you thought it would.
Oh, therein lies a lot of
expectations.
Oh,
yes.
My goodness. Yes. The unmet expectations. Yeah. Yeah. The dreams that we used to have, right? Or the dreams or how we thought it would be, you know, our vision of the future.
Lots of grief.
And that, yeah, we grieve that loss too.
We're getting into the whole caregiving topic, which is actually my whole topic next month. November is National Family Caregiver Month. But I think we have seen women in caregiving roles, and I think it was Rosalind Carter that said, everyone falls into one of four categories. You either are a caregiver, were a caregiver, will be a caregiver, or received care yourself. So that topic and the coping tools around it should be of important attention to everyone, because we will all be touched in some way, shape, or form.
And I might add a fifth one.
Oh, okay.
You know a caregiver. Therefore, you need to support a caregiver.
For Very certain.
Good. And I, you know, it is about the expectations. I have a friend that their son ended up having a spinal injury, changed their entire life.
Of course.
And so she became the caregiver for a period of time. And I remember one thing she said was, I liked my little life before this happened.
Right.
And so whether you lose a spouse or have any other loss in your life, it's a lot of the same feelings. So on the what can we do now side of things, Marie, when you are working with women with really any kind of loss, I would assume there are some key skills, techniques, tools that you try to help them be aware of and start to use to help. I'm assuming the biggest challenge is moving through and identifying who am I now.
Yeah, but even before you get there, the very first thing, it doesn't matter what kind of transition my clients are going through, and they vary widely. The very first thing I recommend they do is create their trusted advisor board. I call it my personal board of directors. Mm. A couple of my clients like to call it their band of angels. These are people that we surround ourselves with, like you, Marie, and you, Heather, right? And as our needs change and we no longer need the financial or legal advice, you guys might get replaced on the board with someone else who meets a different need as time goes on. So this is a dynamic group of people who are trusted advisors, who when we are not able to make clear decisions for ourselves, or we're out of our zone of genius and we need some advice from a professional, those are the kinds of people we need to have on our board, personal board of directors. And as I said, it's a dynamic board, and the people on it change as our needs change. So as a woman gets past this part of needing financial and legal advice, and now you guys are on, you know, on a maintenance mode for them kind of thing, she may then move into the, okay, now what do I do about the who am I now? And she may need a different set of people to help support that and help keep her accountable to moving through that process.
I love the recognition that it's wisest, if possible, to surround yourself with this board, this group of angels, this tribe, this we're creatures of community as women, as a previous guest of mine had shared, before you actually need them. Or each other. I mean, we all need to do this so that when you are not emotionally able to think clearly, because that brain fog is a reality. It's a physiological thing that happens.
Right.
Where I just think of a door in the middle of your brain where emotions are on one side, logic is on the other side. And when emotion fills up, slams the door and the logic is gone. You're just not engaged there anymore. So you're bored. Your tribe, your band of angels would be around you to help you weather through that.
Right. And thinking very carefully about who's on that board a lot of my clients say, oh, I have a really good friend who's that for me. Mm. And I just have to challenge her that's putting a whole lot of stress on one person. And does your friend have, in her bag of tricks, the ability to give you financial advice, legal advice, real estate advice, and whatever else the advice might be? Mm-hmm. The answer is almost always no. And I just strongly suggest that person who's so important in your life have a role on your board, but that's sounding board or go to the movie, go out for a glass of wine, kind of, mm-hmm. and let me just vent. Let me just hear me. That's a beautiful spot for that kind of person on your board.
I would agree with you wholeheartedly. Let that person be your friend.
Exactly.
Because that's when you really need them.
That's right.
Heather, I'm thinking of you as we're talking about this because in my mind, those are very likely the same people that you are thinking of for powers of attorney. This is the what if I do end up in the hospital and now I can't take care of my finances or talk to the doctor to make my medical decisions. Who's in my tribe? Who have I trusted and told that I trust to serve in this capacity? So how do those legal documents work, those powers of attorney?
So there are two types of powers of attorney. We've got powers of attorney to deal with financial matters, and we have powers of attorney to deal with medical matters. And one of the keys to both of those, frankly, is making good choices about who we put in those positions to make those decisions. It's important to not only trust the person, but make sure that the person is someone who would be able to make the decisions that you would make as opposed to the decisions that they might want to make. And I think that's particularly true when we look at the medical side of things, because it's not always easy, particularly if it's a family member we're very close to. We might think that, you know, well, our children are closest to us or our spouse is closest to us and they can make the decisions that I would make. If you really think about it, is that person going to be able to make that call to say, enough, we've done enough, we're not going any further? What is that person's personality like? Can they make that call? And those are the things you have to think about when you're thinking about who to appoint.
Can they separate the emotion
That's right.
from the decision? Yeah,
absolutely.
I heard a speaker once very bluntly say, who you authorize to pull the plug might not be the same one you want to write the checks. And those are two different skill sets.
Absolutely.
Right?
Completely yeah. different.
So your point is well taken, Heather.
Yeah.
And to the pull the plug concept, mm-hmm. If we have a living will in place, and I, like you earlier, said I wish we could just scrap all these terms and start over. It's too
Thank
confusing.
You.
A will versus a living will, but a living will is actually a medical directive that lets us indicate our end-of-life decisions. So if we have that in place, the chances of needing that whole pull the plug decision maker should be more minimized because it gives you the ability to say, if I'm in that place with specific parameters, here's what I don't want you to do. So that's part of that process.
And having that in place is just the first step, making sure your doctors and you have a copy of that at the hospital that you go to so that they are aware. And again, you're not relying on that spouse who may be emotional to supply that.
Absolutely. It's important to make sure your doctors have it. And actually, in the state of Arizona, the Secretary of State's office has a service in which you can lodge your medical directives with them for free. And then those documents are accessible by any hospital in the state by way of a code. So I would say anybody who has their medical directives, fill out that registration form, send it into the Secretary of State's office. They'll issue you a verification form that you sign, return, and then they will issue you a little identification card that you can keep in your wallet, buy your driver's license, so that if you were ever asked, and you will be, if you're ever in the hospital, they always ask you, you can pull out that card, give them the code, and they have access to those medical directives. And if you are, heaven forbid, unconscious and brought in and they look for your identification, they will find that code and then be able to access who your important decision makers are.
That's brilliant. I didn't know that.
Not every state offers that either.
No. And this is strictly the medical directives. This is not sharing your financial information.
Right.
This is just, who are my choices for making medical decisions? Who have I authorized to get information? And do I have a living will in place? And what are my choices? that's what that encompasses.
I remember when I moved here about 8 years ago, that was one thing I learned about that we did not have in Wisconsin. And oftentimes when I'm talking to folks, groups, clients, whatever, about estate planning documents, that's often the one thing they have in place because they are fill-in-the-blank forms that you can have, you know, an over 18-year-old non-medical, non-relative person witness for you. So because they don't have to have the extra inertia of seeing an attorney to get them in place, they at least put that in place and submit it to the state. It's, I believe, the website, because I'm always looking it up to let people know that at a minimum, if you have nothing in place, start with this, and then let's get you an appointment with an estate planning attorney. But azsos.gov is where they have those advanced healthcare directive forms.
I would just say be mindful. There's a number of issues in particular when we're using canned forms.
Sure.
But one issue in particular that comes up is many of the pre-prepared forms indicate that if I am in a situation where a living will should kick in, that I don't wish to have any sort of hydration. That may be something you want to really think seriously about. Because if you are a person who would like pain relief, if you're experiencing something like this, if you don't authorize hydration of any type, you're going to minimize the options that you have available to you at that point. And those are things that, unfortunately, people don't realize until they're in that place. And at that point, it's too late. So just be mindful if you're going to use something without guidance,
right,
that there are things in there to look for that you might not even realize you should be looking for.
That's a great point, because then in the healthcare power of attorney document that they would hopefully do in addition with an attorney, that's where you could clarify and specify some of that information.
You can, but if documents are done correctly, your living will should really trump your medical power of attorney. Because if those are decisions that you are clear on about how you want those end of life situations to run, you don't necessarily want your medical power of attorney to be able to overturn them.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to want to be mindful about how they work together.
Sure.
And are there specific parameters under which one can overturn the other. So those are things to know as well.
Okay. And talk to us about the financial power of attorney. I know they call it the durable power of attorney. Once again, they don't call it the financial power of attorney. That would make too much sense to all of us. It's the durable power of attorney, which means financial power of attorney.
Right. And there's two approaches to that. It's I'm turning over my ability to manage my affairs now to who I'm appointing, which I rarely suggest. Or it's one that's going to sort of spring into action when you are determined to be incapacitated. One of the keys to know about that is that of late, a number of institutions have created their own policies and procedures about their willingness to accept those financial powers of attorney, which is another reason why people will consider a trust. Because if your financial power of attorney is not accepted at the time it is presented, then we're in that same problem situation again, because the party is incapacitated. They can't sign anything new. And now the bank, the investment company, whoever it is, has said, well, your financial power of attorney does not meet our protocols and policies, so we can't accept it. And so now the people you've appointed to help you are stuck with no other option but to go into court and get themselves appointed your conservator and or your guardian for medical decisions. Not a situation that your family wants to be in when we're in the throes of chaos to now have to involve a court on top of it and then potentially try to guess what they would have wanted, what you would have wanted them to do.
Right.
So it also factors in uncertainty, because if somebody is having to go in to get themselves appointed, what if the person who decides to go in and get themselves appointed, your conservator or guardian, is not the person you would have picked? You have no control over it at that point because you're incapacitated.
Mm-hmm.
So having these things set up ahead of time can avoid those problems as well.
Oh boy. If a personal board of directors is not very clear, the need and the benefit of it, after that, I don't know what is.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Maria, I know as we're talking about the legal document side of this, that alone is very mind-boggling and stressful on the brain, and you can get the deer in the headlights kind of analysis paralysis going on. So help us. I know you've written a book about transitioning through life in general. But are there some things that you think are what might be helpful strategies for women moving through loss that you've probably shared in your book or maybe on some of your video podcasting?
There are several. The first one I want everyone to understand, and especially women who come at this grief and loss thing often as a, I'm strong, I'm smart, I'm resilient, I can handle this, I can do it by myself. And they are surprised often by how grief can overtake them. And they feel often like they are, it's not normal. And I want them to know that grief is normal and that it operates in a very, in a defined way, and then not so much. So it ebbs and it flows for sure. It can come on like a tsunami. And then sometimes it feels more like a gentle wave. And then when you just about the, when you think you're done, it comes back again. And for over a period of time, depending on who you are. So grief is, it's normal, and only you know when you're ready to move on. So often we have people around us who say, okay, it's time. You know, you've been through enough. It's time for you to move on. It's time for you to stop feeling the way you're feeling. Mm. And I don't believe anyone can dictate that to us. I think we feel that in our hearts and in our souls. And we know when we're ready to figure out, who am I now?
That's a really good point. I know in the financial world, we will often share right up front that because of brain fog and the trauma of surviving through whatever loss you've survived through, whether it's divorce or death, et cetera, that it's a good practice to not make major decisions for oftentimes 6 to 12 months.
Exactly.
Because like you say, grief is a different process, time frame wise, backwards, forwards, 2 steps back, 3 steps forward, 10 steps back, and everyone is different. There's no right or wrong.
Right, right.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there are so many times during that, the early stages, though, where decisions are required to be made.
Right.
That's when the board of directors comes
in. That's what I was
thinking. Right. That's when you, that's one of the reasons why having a board of trusted advisors is so crucial. Someone to rely on to help you make those decisions, because you're right. It's one of the other things I do suggest is delay those big, important decisions. Delay whether you're going to move out of your house. Don't make that decision right away. And there are so many others. Yeah, but having that board of directors, because some decisions have to be made.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I would think, too, that's a great time for you and your counseling to be able to remind women that just because they're relying on other people for assistance doesn't make them any less strong.
Of course.
It's okay to rely on other people and know that you are still strong and capable, and you will at some point come back to feeling that way again.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I think our society in general looks at successful people as a person who made it to the top of whatever it is we're admiring them for. And the truthful ones share and recognize that I could have never done this by myself. There's always someone, something, some circumstances behind them. So the whole feeling like, and you, we were talking even before our conversation today, women tend to put their heads down and know that they can get through this and they're going to, and I can do this. And it's like an unspoken, by myself.
Right. The truth is, they can. I did it for a long time. What I learned is once I was brave enough to reach out for help, it got a lot easier for me. Having trusted people around me, having coaches and accountability partners around me, it just made it easier, and I didn't feel so alone. So the truth is, many women can do it all by themselves, but I believe the day of the lone wolf is over, and it's just so much better easier. You can do it with more dignity and grace when you have people you care about who trust you, have your back, whom you trust to be there for you.
And I was a registered dietitian for about 13 years. I helped people balance their diet and exercise before I shifted into my business minor in the world of finance. And now I've been helping people balance their finances for almost the last 20 years. But my background on the diet and exercise aspect of life, you're right, spot on, saying it is easier and better, and I would say healthier.
Yeah.
To not rely solely on yourself, because part of what's been, and I've known this for so long, but my most recent aha is don't forget that your brain, whether it's having positive thoughts or negative thoughts, is triggering chemicals to be released in your body. So is it healthier and wiser for you to continue to struggle through by yourself where it's much more stressful, stress in the brain?
Mm-hmm.
You are bathing your body in cortisol and other negative chemicals. You are slowly killing yourself. Versus if you had positive thoughts and positive reinforcement from this board of wonderful women around you, now you're bathing your body in helpful, healthful chemicals. It's all about chemicals. Why would we ever choose? Yeah, no, I'm going to go with the negative ones and we're just going to slowly kill ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
We wouldn't do that intentionally. So that whole can you do it? Yes, you're capable. You can do it, but it'll be easier. It'll be healthier, better for you, better for those around you in the long run, physiologically.
Exactly. And you can't give from an empty cup. So if you have totally devoided your cup of of every little bit of good about you, you can't give from there and be your best self. So it's time to fill up your cup and give from the overflow.
Very good.
Absolutely, because likelihood is, if you're suffering loss, you have some other family members around you who are probably looking to you for some support as well.
You bet.
And so when you've got that empty cup, you can't be that caregiver to your other family members that you probably desperately want to be.
Amen to that.
It's that whole, don't you hate when cliches are so right? If mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. It's the truth.
Absolutely. And what's the one from the airline? Put your mask on first, right?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Put your own
yes.
mask on first before you help somebody else. So you got to fill your cup.
That says it all. Absolutely. Well, with that, ladies, I'm going to reflect back to you a couple of takeaways that I appreciate hearing from both of you. And you can add to that, tweak that as you wish, inviting again our listeners to pick out the one thing that they want to act on in their own lives, maybe after listening in today. And then I'll also ask you to share with our listeners, where can they find out more about you, your business, ways to contact you, those kinds of things. So Maria, I'll start with you. The whole peace of mind thing, I think, is a major message that from a doing standpoint, you have peace of mind if you have your estate plans and your financial affairs in order. So taking control of what you can control, I think estate planning and financial are one of those areas. So take control financially and or estate planning for that peace of mind was one key, I think, great piece of advice. Another was even, you know, before we need it now, creating our trusted advisor board, our band of angels, our tribe, whatever we want to call that group, that we really will be much more better off rather than just doing it as one person ourselves. And then the third is recognizing, and I don't know what the to-do is, but recognizing that through loss especially, we need to identify who we are going forward. So maybe that's when they should read your book. That would be the to-do. Read your book to learn how to get through that transition.
Yeah, I think the to-do there is simply just to be present and mindful that this is likely a stage that you will evolve to. And there may not be something to do about it now, depending on where you are in your process of loss. But acknowledging the fact that this stage will likely come, and there are some things you can do to prepare for when you are ready.
Awesome. Great.
And reading my book would help you prepare.
I was just going to say, and how would they do that? Tell us about your website and how to best reach you.
Oh, thank you. So my website is transitionandthrivewithmaria.com. And you will find my my book is on there. My podcast is there, so you can listen to some inspiring conversations I have with women about all kinds of transition. And there's a free ebook on that site as well.
Awesome. Thank you. And Heather, on the legal side, trying to condense, you know, the all the different documents we talked about, but the whole point of the state has a plan for you was, I think, a really good reminder. So even if you don't have documents in place, well, the state has a plan for you. And if that's what you want, that's what will happen unless you put a will and or trust in place. So good reminder. Secondly, is that a will not stop a probate process. So that importance of account titling and beneficiary designations and funding the trust are huge homework items. So if listeners out there have a will or have a trust, that's the next thing to go and look at your assets and see how things are titled and if your beneficiaries are current. And then the last is, as we mentioned, it's even more likely to have something go wrong before you're gone, and that's the whole power of attorney side of things. So maybe a takeaway would be for folks to check out that azsos.gov to get the wallet card, but also make the appointment with the estate planning attorney at the same time.
I would agree. I think the overall theme is communication and planning. There needs to be an overall true plan, not just with documents, but with your family. You can have an estate plan in place, but if you don't have those conversations with your family and let them know what you want and what you don't want and how they need to use the plan when it's time to put it into action, it's going to be of little use. So it's important to keep those lines of communication open. It's important to work with someone you feel comfortable with so that you can be guided through the process. It's not just papers. It's about counseling through the process with someone who has experience and knows how to help you. And I absolutely would agree. One of the takeaways would be, please check with your banks and your investment companies and find out what are their policies on accepting financial powers of attorney. That will be eye-opening for you so that you can figure out whether or not those financial powers of attorney that you have in place are going to actually be accepted when they're needed.
Awesome. And the best way to find you, Heather?
ParkerLawAZ.com. So that's ParkerLawAZ.com is my website. My contact information is there. My office is in Chandler. So you can reach me by phone, by email. You can communicate with me through the website as well and get more information about what we do.
Thank you both for being here. This was hopefully a wonderful wealth of information conversation for our listeners. And I'd like to thank our listeners for listening to this episode of Mind, Money, Motion as well, where we share how to worry less about money and take care of our mind and body. Next month, our guests will be educating us and challenging us to incorporate healthier habits around the subject of caregiving. November is National Family Caregivers Month, and as Rosalyn Carter once wisely observed, that we will all either be a caregiver, are a caregiver, we're already a caregiver, or we'll receive care ourselves, and as Maria mentioned, or what was the fifth one?
We support caregivers.
That we support caregivers, so there's a fifth category there. My guest next month will help us better understand and share advice about how to thrive healthfully through a caregiving experience from the standpoint of our mind, money, and motion. You can visit us at mindmoneymotion.com or find us on Facebook. Please join us next time for less worry and more life. I'm Marie Burns.